And with that, we're very happy to welcome Dr. Andrew Seeley, who's the Director of Advanced Formation at the Institute of Catholic Liberal Education. He leads conferences, workshops, and consultations for K-12 Catholic schools around the country, dedicated to recovering and renewing the Catholic educational tradition. A passionate teacher and learner, Dr. Seeley is a tutor at Thomas Aquinas College in California and a member of the School Scholar Advisory Board at Wyoming Catholic College and the National Policy Advisory Board for the Catholic High School Honor Roll. Dr. Seeley received a licentiate from the Pontifical Institute in Medieval Studies in Toronto and a PhD in Medieval Studies from the University of Toronto in 1995. He's taught joyfully and extensively in all areas of a Great Books curriculum. Dr. Seeley and his wife Lisa have 6 children and 4 grandchildren. So again, thank you so much for being here tonight, and we're really looking forward to hearing.
I'm very grateful to Bryce Carson and the other organizers of the First Educator Series for inviting me out here and being very accommodating and attending to all of my needs. I love coming to Denver. My family and I have a lot of friends here. We've broken down cars many times traveling across country in Denver, and so we've gotten to know people here. Also, our institute work has been very well received, and we've been able to help a number of schools in the Denver area. And now, having spent some time with the pastor here at St. Mary's and being able to meet some of the parents this evening attending Mass, I have a new reason to love Denver because of seeing how wonderful a community you have here at St. Mary's. And also, I'm very impressed with how many of you parents would brave such a difficult weather situation tonight because of your commitment to being the primary educators of your children. It's edifying to me to have you all come out here for a series like this. I want to start by telling you what happened to me this morning as I flew into Denver's airport this morning, and I got on the rental car shuttle, and I happened to sit next to a family with 4 young children and a lot of suitcases. And I wasn't really paying attention to what was going on. All of a sudden, I realized the mother was throwing out math questions to her son across the aisle, and he was answering all these questions, multiplication tables, division problems, addition, and he was having a great time, and she was, I guess she was showing him off to the person who was sitting next to them. And so I said, well, I guess he passes that. And I asked her whether he learned his multiplication tables in school, because I wasn't even sure they taught them in most schools nowadays. And she said, no, he's only in first grade. And I said, well, how did he come to learn them? She said, well, I could tell when he was 2 years old that he had a natural aptitude for mathematics, because he asked me if I wanted him to draw a circle for me. And I said, well, why don't you try a sphere? And he said, well, okay, I could crumple up the paper and I could give you the ball. So she recognized at the 2-year-old that there was a real math aptitude there. And so she just started teaching him things like his multiplication tables and what division meant. And so he was able to do all of this as a first grader. And I know that God wanted me to tell you that story because I was actually on the wrong shuttle. I was going to the wrong rental car company. So I know that there was a reason that I was there. And that story embodies some of the things I'd like to talk to you about tonight. One of the things I want to start with is just to say that I am a natural teacher. I love teaching. I have ever since I was, I can remember, I was 8 years old, and I was so excited about having taught my little sister, a 5-year-old, to recognize the word "the." So I took her out and had her read. I'd read the book, and then she'd say "the" every time she saw it. So I was very proud. So I've always loved teaching. I've loved teaching in all the forms that I've experienced it. Not only as I've done some high school teaching, confirmation teaching. I'm a tutor in a Great Books program, but I've also my kids got me into coaching basketball, and my kids got me into directing Shakespeare plays, both of which are really forms of teaching, and I've really loved that. And I must say that I've loved parenting, and when I was looking forward to parenting, I did look forward to holding my kids, but vastly more, I looked forward to teaching them to read and being able to read to them the books that I love. I wondered, when could I read my book? How old would my kid have to be before I'd read The Hobbit to him and The Lord of the Rings? When could I start talking to them about the gospel stories we'd have at Mass and what I thought about them? When could I get into conversations with them? When would they start arguing back with me? You know, that was what I really looked forward to. And I've loved being a parent in a special way because of the way in which it is, so much of it is teaching. And parenting, I've found, is really the most comprehensive and powerful kind of teaching there is. As a parent, teaching is very natural. It comes forth out of the care and the love you have for your kids' happiness and for giving them good things. And it's you have the benefit with your own kids of having the experience of them, of really knowing your children. Teachers take a long time to get to know the kids in their classroom, and by the time they get to know them, they're gone. You know, they move on. So you have that experience of the child, which allows you to tailor your teaching to all the things that they really need. You have the time with them to do that. And a parent is always naturally and expected to be about forming the whole person for their child. So with this sort of thing in mind, I think this kind of line of thought inspired our Institute Vice President Chris Weir in the closing talk at our last national conference. He titled it "The From a Mother's Heart," like what Catholic educators need to know. And in it, he said, and this is available on our YouTube channel, I really recommend watching it. He said, parents are not only primary educators in the sense of being the first educators, but in a real way, parents are the paradigms of education. And teachers should be looking towards parents and parenting and reflecting on their own experience of parenting in order to perfect themselves as teachers. And I've certainly found that in my case. As my kids have grown older and I learned more about them and about what was effective with them and what they needed, my teaching in the classroom has gotten much, much better. So in this book that I want to introduce you to tonight, and it's available on the tables, The Holy See's Teaching on Catholic Schools, Archbishop Michael Miller, the author, says something you've probably heard before in one way or another: parents have the original, primary, and inalienable right to educate children in conformity with the family's moral and religious convictions. But he adds, they are educators because they are parents. So to be a parent involves essentially, and even in the most important part of what you're doing, being educators. So as parents, we have the right, we have the responsibility, and we have the opportunity to educate our children in ways that nobody else has. Also, it's the case you can't help being the primary, that is, the most important educators for your children. Your children will learn more from you than they learn from anybody else, whether you mean to teach them or not. They will pick up your vocabulary. Whatever your vocabulary is, your kids are going to be comfortable with that level of vocabulary. Whatever your interests are, your children will know a lot more about those areas than other kids will. The habits that you have, your kids will learn from your habits. Whether you mean to be telling them about it or not, they'll watch you, and they learn from that. They learn from what you're doing. They learn from the culture that you establish in your home. So I remember being very struck. I didn't grow up in a serious Catholic home, and I was introduced to serious Catholic families when I was in college. So I was visiting a friend of mine in Chicago, and we were hanging out at her house, and all of a sudden it was noon, and the mother went, "Angelus!" She just yelled it around the house. "Angelus!" And then everybody started in the name of the Father. And it's like, whoa, okay. And that was just normal. That was normal for them. So that was the kind of, you know, that was a certain, an important part and a sign of the kind of culture that dominated their home. I was very gratified just this past week when my daughter Elizabeth, who's a senior in college, said to me, I'm so glad we had all those Christmas traditions. Those meant so much to me. And that's in her heart deeply in a way that not very many other things in her educational experience will ever be. So being the primary educator as a parent, it seems to me, is a lot like being the primary health care giver. You are, in fact, the primary health care givers for your kids. That means you are responsible for their nutrition, their exercise or lack thereof, trying to protect them from diseases unless you want them to get chicken pox. I guess there's this, you know, the homeschool moms say, chicken pox here, and they have a big chicken pox party. Don't quite get that. But for the most part, you protect your kids from illness. You're the ones who are aware when something's wrong physically with them, when they're sick. You apply first aid to them. You're the ones who choose the doctor. That's one of the most important choices that you make when you move into a new area. You look very intently around for recommendations for the best doctor you can find for your family. And you judge the doctors. You determine whether you think the doctors are the people to entrust your children to. You are the ones who have to make sure that the doctor's prescriptions and commands are executed by your children and in your family. And with both health and education, if you neglect it, if you don't attend to it and think through what you're doing, your kids will feel it and it will affect them for the rest of their lives. So I think that the church's definition of a school, and maybe surprised to know the church has a definition of a school, at least in one of her documents from the 1980s on education, it proposed a definition for a school. I think that this definition applies to the home as well as to a formal school. And the definition is a privileged place for integral formation by means of a systematic and critical assimilation of culture. It's one of my favorite definitions. But that a school is a place for the integral formation and that it's done by means of an assimilation of culture is very much intensely true of what happens with your children in your home. Now, that it's a systematic and critical assimilation of culture is not usually true of the home. It's helter-skelter kind of things. But the systematic and critical assimilation of culture happens in the school, and it happens with probably a broader experience of culture than any one of us has. So you can see through this definition both that what you're doing is critical to the idea of the education that a school is supposed to offer, but also that collaboration with a formal school is important, so that the school offers things that you can't offer, but you offer more intensely things that the school can only offer partially. So I think the church's definition of a school invites us to collaboration between parent and school. And I think that reading the Holy See's teachings, the Holy See's teaching on Catholic schools book is going to help you both in thinking of ways in which you might more intentionally educate children directly yourself, and also in thinking about ways you can both judge whether a Catholic school is fulfilling its mission, and so fulfilling what you want, what your goal is as a primary educator of your children, and also things that you might do to collaborate with the school. And I also love this book because it's about 75 very short pages, so it's an easy read, and it's a very good summary of the important parts of church documents since the Second Vatican Council on education. So I'm going to introduce you to the book a little bit, and then I'm going to go and talk about ways in which it might help you as parents. In this book, he introduces us to what the church's mind is about education. And he also says this will help you to answer the question, is this a Catholic school according to the mind of the church? So there are many schools that are Catholic because they're recognized by the diocese, they belong to the parish. But are they fully Catholic according to the mind of the church and what the church understands as being fully full Catholic education? He proposes in the book five benchmarks. So he says we're in an assessment culture. So as an assessment culture, you need to have benchmarks. So he proposes five benchmarks. The first is that schools, Catholic schools, need to be inspired by a supernatural vision. They need to be founded on a Christian anthropology. They need to be animated by communion and community. They need to have a Catholic worldview throughout the curriculum. And they need to have teachers who see themselves as witnesses. So I'm going to go through each one of those benchmarks. So the first one is Catholic schools need to be inspired by a supernatural vision. And the way he expresses that is Catholic schools need to see themselves as forming good citizens of the heavenly city and of their earthly city. Excuse me. So he says, the specific purpose of a Catholic school is the formation of boys and girls who will be good citizens of this world and who will also be citizens of the world to come, thus fulfilling their destiny to become saints. So I'm just going to highlight a couple things from there. One of the first is forming. The school needs to see itself as a place of formation, not simply of information. Formation means we're trying to change, we're trying to affect who the person is. We're trying to develop their character. We're trying to develop their innate powers so that they're able to do beautiful and great things. Also, he talks about the schools as forming citizens, not workers, not employees of a company that's going to give them a good salary and take care of them in their adult life. A citizen, it's really interesting, he does say that we want to form them to be saints, but he connects being a saint with being a citizen of the heavenly city. So to be a saint is not just to do good things, but just to understand that you are living your life as an essential part of the Catholic Church, of the Catholic community, that you are a citizen of the church and you're a citizen of your country. You are a part of the whole and you feel like you belong to the whole, that you love the community, and that you want to do what you can to contribute to the community. Now, he points out, for most of the benchmarks, he points out what he thinks are false views about education or false philosophies that can corrupt education. With regard to this first mark of inspired by a supernatural vision, he points out that the pluralism and the multiculturalism in our society can undermine a school's ability to form citizens. In this way, if no one society is better than any other society, then it's really hard to see why you would want to form children as part of a society. So it's that kind of pluralistic approach to culture can be devastating to a Catholic school in terms of its goal, of the goals it wants to achieve in forming their students. Now the second benchmark is founded on a Christian anthropology. So this is versus a secular understanding of, so anthropology, your understanding of what a human being is and what fulfills them. In a secular view, a secular view is one in which there can be no commitment to a spiritual good. The only goods you can think of are ones that apply to, if they're going to be common, that apply to this earthly existence. So what happens is, by default, schools that have a secular anthropology simply educate for money and for production, because everybody agrees that you need to get a good job. Agrees that that's a good. And nobody agrees about anything with regard to what is really important for human beings as in their spiritual capacities. So we just cut that off, and we just focus on the economic vocational aspect. Also, since human beings will continue to want spiritual goods, but as a secular viewpoint, there's no commonly agreed upon goods, you just take by default the idea that everybody creates for themselves the good. So you just want to set everybody free as an individual to create meaning for their own life. So in common, you prepare everybody for a career, and then in particular, you try to push them to just invent themselves. A Christian anthropology is one that says that Christ himself reveals who man is and what we are. And it's Christ himself who fulfills us through the model that he offers and through the relationship that he offers. So some of the earliest theological debates and disputes occurred about how human was Jesus really. So he was divine. But then, did he have a body? Did he have a soul? Did he have a mind? Did he have a will? Each one of those was sort of a new dispute. And the church affirmed Christ had all of the human capacities. And so Christ divinized all of the human capacities. He divinized our hearts, our imaginations, our mind, our memory, our senses, our spirit. He divinized thought, he divinized practice, he divinized us as individual persons, he divinized us as societal beings. So that's our model, is to grow ourselves and help our children grow into divinized, fully divinized human beings. Christ is also the fulfillment of all of those powers. So it's a Catholic viewpoint, and very important for education, that in all of the desires and capacities of the human being, we will meet Christ in their fulfillment, whether explicitly or implicitly. So there's this wonderful passage from Philippians that's a lot of people in the Catholic Reformation of Education movement like to quote. St. Paul says, "Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, think about these things." So you meet Christ in places you don't expect him. You meet Christ when you're doing science, if you're actually discovering the work of, if you're actually discovering the magic of the natural world and its powers and its intelligibility, you're meeting Christ there. If you discover beauty and wonder in mathematical truths, that's meeting Christ who is the Logos. So these are the elements of a Christian anthropology that help us to see Catholic education as being ordered to fulfilling the whole person, and having a wonderful Catholic balance between being ordered towards meeting Christ, but also being able to respect every discipline in its own integrity. Because we have the confidence that Christ, who is the truth, will appear if you're seriously pursuing the truth in whatever area of study. Third one, animated by communion and community. Now, Archbishop Miller contrasts this with an institutional mentality. So, schools can be institutions where systems are set up And we just sort of figure out what part in the system you need to go to and how you kind of work your way through the system. But there isn't time or care, or at least it's second burner, to treat you as a person and to develop the community life within the school. So schools that are animated by communion and community, you find in those schools a love of the common life of the school. So when I took my kids first to St. Augustine Academy, where they went for, most of them went for high school, first time I went there, on the first day of school, I was just overwhelmed by the fact that the kids were obviously happy to be there. They were happy to come back from summer vacation. They were happy, the teachers were happy to be there. That they were all rejoicing in seeing one another again, which is something I never experienced, ever, even dreamed of experiencing in my own education. So having that that love of the common life is crucial to us to making a successful Catholic school. And I think that an important way that it's not only for the teachers and the students, but it involves the families. That community extends to the families.
Oh, thank you.
And so your involvement in the school is crucial. So you should expect a school that will welcome you into the community. Also, the school itself is a community that's part of a larger community. It's part of the church. And so the school needs to connect its students to the larger community in order to be fully Catholic. Because it's a communion and it's a community, it affects how teaching occurs. So Archbishop Miller says it's very important for teachers in a Catholic school to engage in dialogue rather than monologue, to not just talk and expect students to take it down, but to engage in a kind of conversation as much as possible, which allows it to be a real communication between human beings. Also, this idea affects the physical environment. Archbishop Miller says Catholic schools should be home-like, should look in a way that makes the students and the parents feel like they're coming into an extension of the home. He says it should be evidently Catholic. It should be obvious from crucifixes and religious pictures and other things that this is a Catholic place you're coming into. He says it also should be sacramental, so that there should be beautiful things there which aren't necessarily explicitly religious, but which are inviting you to an experience of beauty which opens you up to the divine in the decorations. Finally, it should be a place of prayer, a life of prayer, a common life of prayer should permeate the school. The fourth mark, a Catholic worldview, there should be a Catholic worldview throughout the curriculum. So it's Catholic schools should not just say that for every discipline, the secular world has expertise, we'll just take their texts and that's what we're going to do, and we're going to teach our kids to do that better than the secular schools do. They need to judge everything in history, in literature, in the approach to science, in music and art, to consider whether there's a Catholic perspective and a drive for wisdom and truth that's found in those curricula. And because of this Catholic worldview, there's an orientation to inspiring a love of wisdom in the students, and a confidence that they can come to know the truth, that the faith opens them up to understanding. It doesn't deny them understanding. Finally, the fifth mark, sustained by a gospel witness. He says, talks about witness. The Greek word for that is martyr. So teachers need to be martyrs, and I'm sure many of them feel that way. Teachers need to witness that what they're giving to their kids is not just something they were told they have to do, but it's they're trying to communicate something that they love, that they see as worthwhile, and that they're sure will be good for the students if the students will accept it. They also, Archbishop Miller says, almost all the teachers in a Catholic school should be Catholic, even if they're teaching in disciplines that seem not related to the faith. If they're Catholic, they will find teaching opportunities in their discipline for their students, and their overall life witness will always be present to the students. Okay, so that's a quick run through. Now, some advice about what you might do as parents based upon these benchmarks. So going back to the first one is we want to be making saint citizens who are citizens of the church and of our own political, our temporal political community. So if you see a school advertising itself as making kids college and career ready, it's probably not rightly oriented, if that's the goal. If they advertise themselves as being a STEM school, and that's the most prominent thing, it's probably not seeing the goal of a Catholic school. On the other hand, if you see that the school says, we're trying to pass on wisdom and virtue, that's much more in the ballpark of what Archbishop Miller is talking about. If they talk about the importance of the Catholic intellectual tradition or immersing kids in Catholic culture, you're probably much more in the ballpark of what Archbishop Miller is talking about. You might ask of the school, what do you teach about the Middle Ages? The Middle Ages was the Catholic millennium. So if the school neglects the Middle Ages, or if they primarily are there to show how the Middle Ages was a dark ages, a time of ignorance and superstition, it's probably not going to be making your students, your kids, feel like they're parts of the Catholic Church, like they want to belong to the Catholic Church. And then you might also ask, what are they teaching about America? Are they neglecting to teach about the United States? Are they neglecting to teach about the foundations of our country? Are they teaching in such a way as to highlight all of the evils that America brings? It's probably not going to make your kids feel like they belong to America or they want to belong to America. At home, you can help your kids to become saints as full members of these communities by really living the domestic church, by making your home prayerful, liturgical. So having special celebrations of the different liturgical seasons, having Advent be a season for you in your home and not just mad preparation for Christmas. By talking about church news, by keeping yourselves informed about what's going on in the church and then talking about it in such a way your kids know that there's activity in the church and good and bad things are happening in it and they become interested in it. You should also celebrate civic holidays and actually try to figure out how to make them meaningful. It's not just another Monday holiday. You want to celebrate Independence Day by reading the Declaration of Independence to your kids or telling stories from the Revolution. Memorial Day. Why are we celebrating Memorial Day? How's that connected to the Civil War? In our family, we often read Thanksgiving proclamations from presidents past and present. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln have some beautiful Thanksgiving proclamations. The Gettysburg Address. You can give the Gettysburg Address as a... have that be something all your kids know and have learned by heart. Those are the sorts of things that will help them connect to their communities. So the second mark, founded on a Christian anthropology... When I see schools advertising themselves as rigorous, I get anxious. To me, rigorous usually means like rigor mortis. The kids are being beaten to death by the amount of work. They're rigorous because the kids are crushed by the amount of homework they have to do. And also, if the schools advertise themselves as having iPads and being a sort of an iPad-based classroom, it's usually not, they're usually not focused properly on a Christian anthropology. On the other hand, if they talk about themselves as ordered towards virtue, towards forming the virtues in the students, that's a good sign. It means they see that they want to be having an impact on the students' character, so that they're changing them to help them delight in good things. You want to see that they're trying to attend to not just giving them information that they can repeat on tests, but that they're developing their imagination. They're introducing them to a sense of beauty, to the beauties traditional beauties in music, art, sculpture, architecture, to the beauties of the liturgy. Also, you want to see that the school, they have a sense of loving discipline. That's when I was thinking about what would guide me as a parent. There were the two things that really struck me were I wanted to make my kids feel loved. I wanted them not only to love them, but to make them know that they were loved. But I also wanted to give them discipline. And so that loving discipline, I think, is foundational for parenting and should be present in schools. At home, if you see the Christ-centered character of the person of your children, something you can do is to relax about homework. Don't feel like if your kids don't have 3 hours of homework a night that they're not getting educated properly. Some of the best schools I know have low homework models. They try to make it so that the kids are doing maybe 1 hour of homework a night, maybe 1 hour and a half, something like that. Because they realize that an important part of maturing is having the freedom to pursue things that you find worth, that the kids find worth doing. So relax about expecting high homework demands at school. Also, at home, you want to try to spark in your kids their self-activity. So there's this really great book called The Seven Laws of Teaching, which was written in the 19th century, but it's got a lot of valuable lessons. And one of the things that one of the laws is never, as a teacher, tell the student anything he might be able to figure out for himself. Never do for the kid something which he might be able to do for himself. So when your kids are doing homework and they're having trouble, don't do it for them. Try to ask them, you have to maybe figure out what's going on. Try to ask them the questions that will get them to be able to think it through themselves. For me, as a teacher, as a parent, my kids would ask me, how do you spell X? And my answer was, how do you spell X? I would never tell them how to spell it unless they first tried to spell it first. And you'll find there are all kinds of teachable moments like that, times when your kids would want you to tell them something that you could at least ask them a question to see where they are and make them have the initiative to try to understand it themselves first. Also, kids as they get older are very opinionated. Right? They've got opinions about their teachers, they've got opinions about the school, they've got opinions about everything, mostly negative, critical. So challenge them on that. Like, why do you think that? Give me some evidence. Enter into that kind of conversation with them. Another thing that's very important to do at school, which I think is crucially important, particularly because the imagination has been rooted out. The development of the imagination has been rooted out of education fairly systematically. Literature is no longer read to be able to pass on great stories and a love of story. Literature is read for the development of vocabulary and analytical reasoning. So at home, read to your children. Read from books you enjoy, books that are above their level, but often it's above their vocabulary level in terms of reading vocabulary, But they can follow it if you read it well to them, and not just monotone, but you get into the characters, you read it with some excitement. Read with books that have beautiful illustrations, that grab their attention. Ask them questions about what you've read to them, to see how much they're understanding and what's of interest to them. Take them for walks and point out interesting things to them. Share whatever knowledge you have that they might find of interest. Okay, that was all under Christian anthropology. The third mark, community versus institution. If a school is testing dominated, if a school thinks that its success is measured by test data, it's probably not a school in which a healthy sense of community is being fostered. Education is not really something you can't effectively and thoroughly measure whether you've achieved the results of this kind of education, of the Catholic view of education, by test data and numbers. You can't really test to see whether their soul has been affected by the true, the good, and the beautiful, and whether they've encountered Christ fully by giving them multiple choice tests. So, now testing and data is helpful, but it has to be in the service of a broader understanding of education. So, one of my colleagues, Beth Sullivan, at the Institute, she had her child in school, and it was one of those schools where they reported to the parents, like every day, what the kids' homework scores were and quiz scores and test scores. So in the middle of the first semester, she printed out all of the test scores that she had, all of the quantitative scores that she had for her kid. She laid them out in her living room. It like covered her living room. There were 998 scores that the teachers had entered. Not only is that sort of a really impoverished view of what education is and what you're trying to do with a kid and what measures success for a child, for educating a child, but it also enslaves teachers. If teachers have to be entering, if data is essential and numbers are essential, that means that teachers have to get them and they have to generate them and they have to report them. So your teachers are then dominated by the need to report, and they're not able to focus really on what the child really needs for a whole education. So it's very important as parents that we just relax about that sort of thing. There are a number of reasons why education has become so numbers dominated, but one of them is because parents who care demand them. And so as parents, you need to realize, no, test scores are not telling me what I really want to know about whether my child is being well educated or not. Something else to pay attention to in school is the shadow curriculum. That was a term somebody we work with in the Institute developed. Does the school pay attention to the important formative effects of what goes on outside of the classroom? Does the school pay attention to the dances and make the dances an educative cultural experience? Does the school provide movies and movie nights that are community celebrations and are showing movies that are going to have an important formative effect on the kids? At St. Augustine Academy, they have medieval days and classical days where the whole school has a day of games and performances and food centered around the medieval era or the classical era or the pilgrim era. Another important aspect that's really neglected is choir and singing. Does the school place a high value on training kids to sing and to sing beautiful music? Kids are very able to do it. Does the school see any importance to that? Also, on the home side, I think it's really important to connect your kids to your parish, connect your kids to the diocese, so that they realize hopefully the very good school community that you're a part of, or the homeschooling community they're a part of, that's not the whole church, right? The church is the parish, the church is the diocese, the church is the church universal. And that's something you can do as parents. Visiting religious communities, getting connected with one or two, like that's easy here at St. Mary's, I guess, so that your kids know what religious are like and that's an important part of their experience. Finally, family life provides an irreplaceable experience of community. One of the greatest lacks of our society today is the lack of any experience of community. Because kids grow up in broken homes, they grow up in homes with both parents working, they grow up in homes where there's just no time to be together. They don't even know what community is like. In your own home, things like community building, things like having dinner together, right? Sitting down for dinner together, not always sitting down in front of a movie or something like that. Not allowing everybody to run off. No, we have dinner every night and we get to talk. This is our time to talk. In our house, we never allowed our kids to have media things in their rooms. If you're going to go to your room, you're not going to be on the computer. You're not going to be playing music. If you want to play music, do it in the living room. I can stand it. All right, I'll tolerate your awful music as long as it's going on together and I know what you're listening to and we can talk about it and I can make fun of it. So your room is not a media sanctuary. There is no such thing. If you're going to be in your room, it's because you're doing something, you calligraphy or you're just sitting there staring at the ceiling and being mad at me. That's okay, right? Having family traditions, that's very important. And always, quantity time is more important than quality time. We all love the quality time parts, but that you invest time in your kids, and they know you're there. They know you're there at 11:30 at night when they come in and they want to talk in your bed, you know, and you're, that you're available to them. That's a deep experience of what real community is like. Okay, number four, the Catholic worldview throughout the curriculum. In the school, you want to make sure that they don't think of the Catholic aspect as just being going to Mass, that they don't think of it simply as just being religion class, but that they attend to literature, to history, to history social studies, to science, even to math, but math is kind of hard. I mean, we should reform math, but that's going to be hard to do. How does the school approach these disciplines? What are they reading in them? Are they just taking a secular history textbook and using that? That's always a mistake. In the home, it's very important here to develop your own love of learning. The more that you develop your own love of learning just because it's interesting, the more naturally you're going to share that with your children. So reading things in the Catholic intellectual tradition, G.K. Chesterton, Tolkien, my favorite, Bishop Barron, a lot of his things, the Catholicism series, Dante, reading a good book on church history so that you know that well. Developing yourself in those ways means you're going to be able to share that with your kids in ways you can't anticipate. Doing things like there are wonderful books. The David McCauley has these really neat books. One's called Cathedral. I think one's called Castle. They're books written for young, fifth grade or something. But they go through the detail of what it meant, what building a cathedral in the Middle Ages involved. What building a castle involved, what building a city involved. They're an incredible learning experience. That's something you have around your house, you read yourself, you share with your kids. It's great. Those kinds of things. And then I always ask my kids every day, well, what did you learn that was worthwhile today? Tell me one thing you learned that was worthwhile today. I think I drove them crazy with that. And in fact, my wife sounds like they had like anxiety attacks. What am I going to tell Dad about that? But you know, what did you learn? And not only because you want to make sure they're learning stuff that's worthwhile, but also because a lot of times you'll find they've learned interesting things you didn't know about. And you can actually learn from them, and that can be a great boost for them in terms of their own motivation to learn. Finally, to be witnesses, you definitely want to see that the school is full of committed, faithful Catholic teachers in every area. You want to see that the teachers are passionate for their subjects, they're passionate for the church, and they're passionate for children and for teaching. You'd like to see that that prayer is an important part of the life. You would like to see crucifixes in the rooms. You'd like to see beautiful, interesting art in the classrooms and not just loud pictures and cat posters and empty, ephemeral slogans. One of my great disappointments was watching the Lego movie where they made fun of cat posters, but in the end they come back and they embrace cat posters in the end. I was very disappointed in that. I was so excited that a movie was making fun of cat posters. But also you want to see that in the school, the teachers have a responsibility for educating. The primary responsibility for educating the classroom lies with them, which also means they have the freedom to make judgments about what's worth doing and how to go about it. There was one of the Dominican sisters that we've done programs with said she was just aghast when she was on part of an accrediting team that was visiting a school. And she found out that the teachers had to submit lesson plans every week where they said what they were going to be doing in the classroom every 5 minutes. They broke up every period into 5-minute increments. And they knew that when the administrator came into the room, they weren't at the place they said they were going to be, they were going to be in trouble. That's really just enslaving teachers so that they can't do what they're meant to do. So make sure that they have the responsibility and the freedom to do their work. In the home, you want to encourage respect for authority with your kids. You want to make your kids coachable. You want to give them an attitude where they expect to learn from the adults who are in authority over them. And if they don't think they're learning, at least they have the respect not to be mouthy and to do the work they're supposed to do, whether they think it's worthwhile or not. Now, of course, you listen to your kids, and if they're complaining about things and it sounds like it's getting serious, then you might want to investigate yourself. But their default attitude should be to expect to learn from their coaches. Their teachers and their coaches will appreciate that. You want to support the school and the teachers. One of the really terrible things about modern parenting is that parents tend to, if the kid complains or if something is wrong, they go after the schools rather than going after their kids. It should be the other way around. It should be that you trust your schools enough to support the schools and encourage your kids and make your kids to meet with their responsibilities there. And then also dialogue with your kids, talk with them, listen to them. Listening to kids is annoying, but listen to them, ask them questions, try to find out what's going on, make it so that they feel like they're open to tell you what's on their mind. An important experience when I was young was I ended up being convinced by a teacher in a Catholic school that hell didn't exist. God didn't send anybody to hell. So I told my dad that, and he freaked out. And so he just yelled, kind of just tried to drive into me over and over again that, no, the church teaches. And it didn't really work because every time I started to say something, he would say, yeah, but, and then talk for 5 more minutes. So I really needed him to listen to me and not be afraid to let me think this through and help me think it through rather than just come down on me about it. Okay, so coming to a conclusion here, beautiful things happen when these benchmarks are lived. So I have made a study of valedictorian addresses from Catholic schools over the, you know, Catholic schools that I've been able to find over the last decade. Because I think that if you want to know how good a school is and what a good job they're doing, why don't you listen to the speeches that their supposedly best students give in the most important part of their high school life? Most valedictorian addresses are not worth listening to, which makes you kind of gives you a good sense of what the education is really about. But the schools that I've been blessed to work with just produce students whose valedictorian addresses, time and time again, will just blow you away. So with regard, I'm just going to, little quotes from each of the benchmarks. From the first one, inspired by a supernatural vision, one of the student valedictorians said, "I could tell you 100 stories without adequately expressing what our experience at school has meant to me and to my classmates. All of our years here have been one tremendous experience of truth, of goodness, and of beauty." If you hear a valedictorian give an address like that, you want to send your kid to that school. With regard to the second one, founded on a Christian anthropology, our parents know, our teachers know, and our classmates know that what brought us together was a pursuit of truth and the love of a person, Jesus Christ, and that we will always share, that we will always share no matter how many miles separate us. That's what you want to have your kids say when they're the valedictorian at the high school. And what's cool about these is not just that the students say them, but you can tell that they know their classmates are going to be excited to hear them say this. So it's part of the whole ethos of the school. With regard to community, so that one was with regard to community. Nope. What did I just do? Oh, I have the same one there. Never mind. I'm going to go on to the fourth one. I accidentally put the same one down twice. I have another one somewhere, but I don't have it with me. The fourth one, Catholic worldview throughout the curriculum. So the reason I got onto these valedictorian addresses was back in 2007, one of the kids at my at St. Augustine Academy gave the valedictorian address. And in it, she talked about what they had done in their English class in their senior year, where they had read some Shakespeare and somebody else. Then they had read, like, Catcher in the Rye and the Great Gatsby. And then they read Evelyn Waugh, Brideshead Revisited, and some Flannery O'Connor. And so she kind of went through that and why that sequence was significant to her and her classmates. She ended by saying, "Waugh and O'Connor did not mask man's sinfulness or the evils of the world, but they did not present these as the only realities. They acknowledged the problems with fallen man and with the world, but then pointed to God as the one who can solve these problems." And another valedictorian said about her experience, "We were each caught and enslaved by wonder. We had to know, and we could not really be at rest until we had." And then with regard to the teachers as witnesses, "We learn so much from the teachers here because their enthusiasm is contagious. They love what they teach, and their wholehearted dedication both to us and to knowledge is so inspiring. From our teachers, we learn that it is not enough to know the truth. We must love the truth. What we have learned and seen here has set us off on an adventure which will never end." Okay, so the last one, and I'll end with this. St. Mary's High School in Phoenix is a diocesan school, 100-year-old diocesan school, in the heart of downtown Phoenix. Draws kids from all over Phoenix, most of them very badly educated. In 2012, they reoriented their school to an explicit Catholic view centered on wisdom and virtue as their cornerstones for what they're going to do with their kids. So this is just a part of the mission statement. "This is the central aspect of the mission of St. Mary's Catholic High School, to draw students through their understanding of the created world into a deeper relationship with Jesus Christ, through whom and for whom all was created. And this was a test of my valedictorian theory, because and a successful test. So the valedictorian address given by the valedictorian of the class that entered as freshmen, the first group that entered into the new St. Mary's, gave the most wonderful and amazing valedictorian address. And here's a part of it. So class of 2016, this is my final address to you. When you wake up one day wanting more, thirsting for something true in this beauty-deprived, surface-level, and sugar-coated society, drowning in the very lifelessness of its people, start with Christ, encounter the living truth, and never let him go. This is the most important thing I can tell you. There is truth. Go out and find it, and with that truth, make a difference. Thank you.